and welcome back to Playthings. I'm your host, Gabriel Escobedo.
And I'm your co-host, Aaron Jimenez.
And we'd like to welcome you to today's podcast. So before we start, I want to introduce Aaron Jimenez. Madeline, unfortunately, is unable to continue podcasting with us at this time. She's not permanently out, but she does have a full load with college and work, and, you know, it's just a lot for a person to take on right now. However, Aaron has agreed to do this wonderful thing with me, and I'm going to ask him to do a little bit of an introduction. Go on, would you, please?
Hey, everyone. So I'm Aaron Jimenez. I'm 28. I'm originally from Texas. I now live in the northern part of the United States. A few things about me. I'm lactose intolerant, but I love dairy. I'm bilingual. I speak both English and Spanish fluently. I love music, which is what brings me here. I'm that one person who knows a little too much about all your favorite musicals. And I have been singing since I could hold a note. So I'm here for another perspective, I guess, like the general public perspective. I'm a huge gamer, love video games. I'm just here to, you know, get to know everybody and get to tell you guys my story through the stuff that we read.
Thank you, Aaron. And y'all, believe me when I say Aaron can hold a note for days on top of doing the Macarena. All right. Thank you for that introduction. So today we are talking about I Am My Own Wife, a play written by the playwright, obviously, Doug Wright. Playwright, right? I'm digging it. It's like he was born to do this. So let's get into it. Just a few quick facts about Doug. He was born on December 20th of 1962 in Dallas, Texas. He graduated from Yale University in 1985. He got a Master of Fine Arts from New York University. This play, I Am My Own Wife, was first produced off-Broadway, and I believe it was 2004. I think that's correct, but if y'all want, y'all can fact-check me on that. He wrote the book for the musical War Paint. The story that we are talking about today is very personal to him because he is a gay man. So he felt that the story of Charlotte von Malsdorf, who this play is about, was very important to him in order to learn more about his own history and the history of the queer community in general. Now, Charlotte, the centerpiece of this story, was born March 18th of 1928. She died April 30th of 2002. So Charlotte was actually a transgender woman who lived through the rise and fall of both the Nazis and the communist regimes in Germany during, you know, the Second World War and the Cold War. She owned a museum called the Grunterzeit Museum. I think I pronounced that correctly. If I didn't, please don't come for me. That's just a little bit of background on her. We're going to get more into her as we talk about the play, because the play is essentially a biography. It centers technically around Doug trying to get the story of Charlotte, but the story is Charlotte's story, without a doubt. So without further ado, we're going to go into some notes on casting. The original cast of this show was a single male. It's a one-person show. Who, you know, subverted social expectations by wearing Charlotte's attire the entire time. However, I think, and Aaron, feel free to chime in on this, that since the story is mostly Charlotte's story, that it should be portrayed by a trans woman.
And, of course, to chime in on that, I am a trans man. Just on my day-to-day, I use he, they pronouns. I have medically been working on transitioning since, like, 2019, in that area. And so, as a trans person, it's very much not just myself, but almost a new societal expectation in a lot of media that the people who are cast for roles for different, of course, especially marginalized populations need to be accurate to the people they are portraying. So if you're going to put the story of a trans person somewhere, then people are going to expect a trans person to have that role.
Awesome. Thank you. I also go by he, they pronouns. On that note, just in case any of y'all are wondering for, you know, reviews and correspondence, which we hope y'all leave us some because we are all excited to hear what you've got to say about our podcast. And so the setting, of course, isn't one particular time. The setting is in one particular place. That was going to come out of my mouth real weird. So it takes place in Charlotte's museum called the Gründerzeit Museum. And, you know, this spans decades, really. Erin, do you want to talk a little bit about the plots or like where her life story begins?
Right here, major plot points. Okay, so our setting starts in a house / the museum, and we're looking in at some of the first major plot points, of course, where as a trans person, when I started reading this section of the play, I immediately had a connection because, so we start off the setting in the house / museum. We kind of teeter-totter between the two, depending on where in the story we are at. And of course, we hit some of our first major plot points in here as the story begins. And for one, we need to know that Charlotte was born Lothar. I'm butchering this name, and I would like to apologize to anyone who speaks German who just might be listening. I'm going to butcher this name. I will try. Lothar Barfelde. And we kind of start off with a little bit of background stuff. Of course, most things. We're establishing a time. We're establishing a setting. We're establishing a little bit of character. And we start with one of like the first instances where Charlotte kind of is becomes aware of her identity and just her transness in general. And I really identified with it as a trans person because every trans story is different, but I am one of those people that I have known since I was younger because of moments like this that we start off with in the story.
Yes. So what happens in this early phase of her life is she is spending time at her aunt's house, her aunt Louise, and I guess no one is like maybe paying particularly paying any attention to her. So she wanders into her aunt's closet and tries on some of her aunt's clothes. And, you know, this is all anecdotal, so it's being told from Charlotte's perspective. And her aunt walks in, and she's really like the first person to affirm her identity. Her aunt, who like lived on a farm and was like very masculine presenting, even tells her, you know, nature's played a trick, you know, I should have been born a man and you should have been born a girl, which is really nice because this is like, guys, this is like the 19, what year did I say? This is like the 1930s when this is happening. So like, this is not a small deal to be affirmed. And on top of that, her aunt has a book by Magnus Hirschfeld, who at the time was like a pioneer in the study of sex, and especially the study of sex in queer communities. This, something I found out recently from another podcast I listened to, is that you ever see those pictures of like that one really famous picture of like a Nazi book burning? Aaron's mm-hmm. nodding. You can't see it, but
I'm agreeing. Yes, yes,
yes. Okay, so they are actually burning Magnus Hirschfeld's work because it is like it has so much information about like the study of sex and like the I don't know what to call it like the it's like the information that helps people realize who they are. Because like there's actual research on it as opposed to just like, oh hey, these are people, let's shun them or let's you know, be with him in secret. You know, there's like actual scientific research that's being published here.
They were burning almost a resource for young queers, not necessarily by age, but in finding out who they are for themselves. A resource that that could have been passed down by anybody to anyone.
Yes. It was a sad event. Like, a lot of research was destroyed, and you know, that's part of our history that was destroyed. But we're here today, and we're going to keep being here forever. So as we go on through the play, we discover in no particular order that Charlotte survived an abusive father. He beat her and her mother. He was a Nazi. Yuck. Hate that. But she did end up killing him because at one point, well, you know, she and her mom were sent to live with their aunt in the country because of the bombings that were going on. And he appeared and threatened to kill them. And at one point, Charlotte ended up back in his care, and she ended up killing him. But she was not... She did go to youth prison for that, because, you know, murder, bad. But it was actually through sheer chance that she escaped, because during a Russian air bombing, the prison was broken open, or exploded open, I guess you could say. Busted open. And she was able to escape through that means, because a guard was like, run for your life. And so she did.
And so I actually did a little digging into this part of it itself, because I'm a true crime fanatic, in the sense that I like knowing the psychological aspects of it all. And so I found this one document from the GLBTQ archive, actually, by Claude J. Summers, and it goes a little bit into it in the sense that it talks about just kind of like a little more factual on the events, where of course it goes into how her father threatened to kill their family, and the way she talks about what ensued, which is she struck her father dead with a rolling pin in his sleep, is she talks about it from a self defense preventative, to not only save their lives but to save others' lives. And it claims that, you know, she was said to say that she feels neither hatred nor a need for revenge, but was forced to circumvent his designs on the lives of my mother, sister, and brother. And as someone who lives, my purpose isn't to live against of the beliefs of my family, but as someone who is in recovery, as someone who just, my moral compass does not align with my family's, I can hold empathy for the fact that it was one of those things where she felt she needed to not prescribe to her family so deeply that it ended up in the way that it did.
Well said. Well said, indeed. So moving on, we go to the period of life where Charlotte, so throughout her whole life, Charlotte's collected things. There was a tavern known as the Moolock Ritz, and it was a restaurant for queer people. You know, a lot of great thinkers went there. Bertolt Brecht, who, if any of you are listening to this, you may know Ev as a playwright who wrote, I think it's called The Circle, which is like a retelling of the King Solomon story. You've got Marlene Dietrich, a very famous German actress. And, of course, Magnus Hirschfeld. So all of these people patroned this tavern, and the communists were going to shut it down, and instead, Charlotte, you know, swoops in and tries to collect as much as she can. And when she does, after she does, of course, the bar is raided and destroyed and wiped out. But she uses the things that she got from that tavern to furnish her own place and basically turns it into a meeting place for the gays in both, like, the societal way and also, like, the sexy way.
I was going to say, to put it in a phrase that we both know, in the biblical way.
The biblical way, yes, yes. Think of it as your good old-fashioned sex club.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, right after this, we do flash forward a bit because we see that Charlotte is receiving, on behalf of the cultural ministry, she receives a Medal of Honor. And I think I can avoid saying it because this is just very long.
Mm-hmm.
Did you want to try it?
No, I didn't want to try it, but I did find like a translation for it. It's essentially like the service cross of, and then there is the Buddhist Republic, I believe, was the name of the award.
Yes, which is officially the Federal Republic of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And in this moment, we also see some like awe held for this, for Charlotte, you know, and she herself is thinking, you know, it's good because it'll show that, you know, other people can, like her, can receive a medal. You know, there was no one jeering or making fun of her. She was being honored for her work in preserving all this history from this time period. And then it goes into a little bit about, you know, how the Berlin Wall fell down and how things were becoming much more liberal again. And then we do take a dive into some rather controversial topics of her life, primarily that of her involvement with the communist police known as the Stasi. Aaron, do you want to talk about that?
So I'm looking at where I have my own notes here. Okay, so I have it in here. So I feel like her motive is clear, but it did. I feel like it did definitely come from a place of despising the like East Germany communist regime. She just kind of how she felt about the Nazis. They were just, to quote a phrase that I use all the time, it was the same girl in a different skirt, you know, to her. Which I mean, I can see it. And so I feel like it was another one of those things where, as I read, I immediately went into that place of like, she had to have done this from a preservation place, in the sense of, this is just what I have to do to keep my collection safe. And this is what I have to do to keep like all of these things that I am trying to preserve, to continue to ensure its safety. This is just a part of it. And while controversial, I can definitely say for myself that there is a gratitude that I can sit here and have because she was willing to, you know, play that card, essentially.
Wow, I hadn't thought about it like that. Mm-hmm. No, yeah. And, you know, it later came out that something like 1 in 3 people in East Germany at that time ended up spying on like everyone around them. And of course, you know, some of those records aren't necessarily reliable, but there was talk about her being stripped of her Medal of Honor because of her involvement, which eventually never panned out. I didn't find anything about that happening. But yeah, she was really willing to take those risks for the things she loved. There's even a part in this play where she mentions, you know, she was propositioned by someone on her way to get an antique clock. And she was like, it's rude to keep a clock maker waiting. And so she dipped on the dude and was like, I need my antiques. I need my furniture. Give it here. Because that is just how much, you know, preserving her culture meant to her.
Mm-hmm.
And then we do find out that one of her friends was eventually imprisoned because of her. Now, it's hard to tell who did what, because again, this is such a personal and subjective story and told from her point of view. And again, those documents we mentioned do conflict with like the actual truth of things. In one instance, her friend Alfred Kirschner, or Kirschfeld, I'm sorry, is in jail because he asked her to like give him up so she wouldn't be sent to prison. And in another, like in some of those files that the police had on her, it was, you know, was working for us for months, or she was working for us for months, and she landed Alfred in jail intentionally because she might have been getting like some sort of kickback from the police, or like immunity or like special favor. And then in other police reports, it's like her testimony is not reliable at all. Alfred Kirschfeld does eventually die in prison with nothing to his name, because after he's imprisoned, his home is ransacked. He dies with a bill and some other pieces of paper and maybe a pocket watch, I think. And keep in mind, he started out with like at least 15,000 records. So yeah, he was, I hesitate to say this, but some part of me wants to be like, okay, but were they collectors or were they hoarders? Because, you know, they lived through some trauma.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then towards the end of her life in 1991, she is attacked during a house party. Her and her guest are attacked by neo-Nazis. Fuck them, because we hate neo-Nazis and they can all just disappear from the face of the earth and we would all be better for it. But she ends up moving to Sweden. Checking my notes. Yes, stop. Sweden. After that. And she does move. Her museum. She went from like a 31-room museum. And she took some of her stuff to like an 8-room house. And then she ended up living out a few more years before she returned to visit her museum. And she suffered a fatal heart attack while in the garden there, which is unfortunate, but at the same time, I don't think she would have had it any other way, because she loved that place with everything. She was that place. It's funny, in the introduction to this play, the author makes a note about how in German, the word to receive something in English can translate to become. And so there are points in the play where she's talking about receiving something like a desk or, you know, a cabinet. And she's saying, I became this thing. And I think that's really true. Like the essence of her was in having this piece of history with her. And so, yeah, we've learned about her life. And of course, we've had some side story of Doug along the way, like him being fascinated, him being shocked by Charlotte's actions while she was under police surveillance, her being fascinated. But I do think that they did have a good friendship throughout the time that he knew her.
And so I looked a little more into it, of course, because as I read this story, I became more and more curious. And like the only sources, of course, I have are scanning through what I could on Google Scholar and looking through, you know, old like art, like just gay history archives and forums and places where people talk about this in kind of open spaces. After her death, of course, there was stuff that people were like, well, you know, was this really believable in the sense of her and the murder of her father? I don't want to say murder, because it wasn't necessarily like an act of cold blood, but he did die. So when she killed her dad, and of course a couple other things where it's like, you know, that of course just doubts started to come up after her death. And I feel like someone who is very much like, I'm very much a kind of person that like I want to leave a legacy. That is something that kind of scares me, in the sense that like there are haters even after you're dead who are going to discount the work you did in life, no matter the reason. And so I thought that was an interesting little tidbit that I found out after, you know, reading everything and kind of just doing my own little research while, you know, the weekend happened.
Yes. And just for those of you still curious, that museum is still functioning to this day. I'm not quite sure who owns it. I think it's the city of Berlin. But if you wanted to see any of the history that Charlotte saved, and you have the means, go check it out. You know, we can always be the better for like experiencing history that is not our own. Connect with the past.
It is important to connect with the past because as a huge fan of the character Uncle Iroh from Avatar The Last Airbender, you know, we're supposed to connect to the past in order to not repeat it. It's really important to not only our own personal history, but get out there and learn the history of other places. As someone who grew up in the education system in Texas, there's so much I don't know about anywhere that is not Texas. And of course, yeah. And so it's one of those that, like, especially now that I don't live in Texas, living in another part of the country, I know nothing about the history of anything that's here. You know, I just sit and I think about how much, you know, just self-education is so important. You know, you don't need college. You don't need a lot of these other things that we've almost been grown up with the expectation of, like, you have to have this in order to say that you're educated. There are libraries, like, the resources that you do have access to, they are there, and you just got to do some digging for it. But that's also why things like this exist, where the amount of things you can learn from something as simple as listening to a podcast as well. You know, the education is out there. It's just about, you know, having, like, not knowing how many resources we truly do have in the digital age, that I feel like is such a big, big thing that we need to talk more about.
100% this. All right. So now we're going to move on into just some performance options. Oh, actually, before we do that, I want to talk about just maybe a theme I noticed. And my note's a little funny, but I'm going to read it out to you. And then we can mull it over and then maybe find, like, a grammatically better phrase, way to phrase this. The theme I wrote was separating the self from involvedness. And what I meant by that was, you know, throughout the whole play, we see two sorts of attempted separation of events and, like, being in the event. So obviously we got Charlotte's whole life story, because there are parts of her life that she is either, like, unabashedly, like, unashamed, or she is, like, in her own little denial, bubble of denial. And so, you know, we get that whole mix of, like, the unreliable narrator, like, when someone is telling a story, even if it's their own story, are we getting, like, a full representation of the facts? Are we missing out key information? Are we intentionally being deceived? Or is this just, like, unconscious, like, oh, hey, I'm telling you things, and it's not that I'm trying to lie to you, or even that I am lying. It's just, you know, this is the truth as I see it. So, you know, it leads into conversations of, like, what is the truth? Additionally, you know, the play was written by Mr. Doug Wright. Initially, it was meant to be just, like, a staple of, like, I would call it a historical work. But as it mentions in his notes, like, as he got to know Charlotte, he became intrinsically part of the story. Like, even though there's a fictionalized version of himself in this, it was impossible for him to separate the story of Charlotte's life from him hearing about it, because him hearing about it was how he was able to, like, tell it and honor it in her way. And of course, you know, he did receive permission from Charlotte to write the story, because they were good friends and he asked her, and he got grant money to do it. We love grant money. So that's just like the main thing that I think kept popping up in my head, you know, aside from, like, the obvious themes of, like, preserving queer history, preserving history period in the face of, like, oppressive regimes, and of course those two plus the one, that's three big themes that I got going on. Did you want to say anything about that? Yeah, because, like, I mean, I don't think it was, like, an explicit theme or even one that was, like, meant to present itself, but it's something that it just spoke to me.
It's good.
All right, so performance options. Obviously, this is one heck of a play for anyone to learn. I mean, the text itself is standard print. I would say it's 9 to 70. So it's about 71 pages in length. And that's including stage directions, of course. But it is a one-person show, and the... So I've never done a one-person show. I will just be right up front with that. I've seen bits and pieces of one-person shows in, like, workshops. And kudos to the people who can do it, because those are some fantastic skills, and some I eventually hope to develop. I think some of the things that need to be kept in mind for this performance are going to be one, dialect for sure. You know, having that German, having like a German dialect down pretty well, especially in the region of like Berlin, Walmsdorf. As far as interpretations of the text go, I think the most leeway is granted towards Charlotte, in terms of like where you want to go with it, because at, for the most part, you can like discern where like concepts like denial should be, or pride should be, or like boldness. But there can be some moments where, you know, you're free to do as you want. As far as monologues go, note, we cannot like read like a whole monologue here, because we don't want to violate any performance license, you know, rights issues. We don't want to get sued, basically. But on this edition of the text, which is going to be, you know, the Penguin Books first edition, 2004 print, there are a few monologues that I thought were nice. So on early in the text, on pages 17 through 18, there is a wonderful little bit about how, as I mentioned before, Charlotte's talking about becoming the furniture when she was receiving it. And it's just like a really beautiful moment. You could make a monologue out of the parts where Charlotte's talking about her abusive father. You could like Frankenstein it together, just like stitch pieces of it and cut out like Doug's lines if you had permission to do so. Or if you're just using this as like audition material, you could just go ahead and do it. And then on page 37, we've got Charlotte talking about how she has rescued history through the furniture, and talking about how, like, if only she could, you know, drop like a gramophone, like an old music player needle onto like the table and like hear the voices that were sat at that table through the years. I think it's really just lovely. And then we've got one more on page 46 where Charlotte talks about, you know, her love of music and how it helped her survive, because if she hadn't had them, you know, she might not have made it. You know, I think a lot of people in the arts have used music as an escape at some points, but it's also just like a really sweet mechanism to release any stress or tension. I mean, Aaron, as a music person, you know how cathartic music can be and how healing it can be to the soul enjoy.
Yeah, so I was actually just talking about this with one of my partners the other night, because I was watching Camp Rock again, and it had been ages since I'd seen it. And just in case there are some of you out there who don't know what I'm talking about, Camp Rock was a Disney Channel original movie that was a musical about a girl. Basically, it all boils down to a girl who really, really, really wants to go to a music and arts summer camp, and it kind of just tells her story. So I was watching it because I was talking to my boyfriend about, there's a specific song in Camp Rock that is just about it, because it's the Jonas Brothers who are playing this band Connect Three, and it's a song about how much music means to them. And I was telling my boyfriend that before I heard that song, I didn't have the words for how much music meant to me in regards to, like, there's a line in it that says, music is always on my mind. It's all I think about day and night. And I'm like, yeah, my brain works in music. And it's just something that I feel like music is another language, especially, you know, being a more artsy person and being someone of the arts and of doing crafty things and things like where I have to have my creative mind going at all time. Music is almost another language for me, where if I cannot think of how to express myself or communicate effectively, I know that I probably have something in the library of thousands upon thousands of songs that can express the feelings that I'm trying to communicate to somebody.
I dig it. I dig it a lot. All right, so moving on to design choices. Scenic design. The options for scenic design, in the author's notes, we've got the mention of, like, this all taking place in one room in Charlotte's Museum, which I believe is, like, the living room. And you see, you know, all the, I don't want to call them knickknacks, but all the things that she's collected over the years. So shelves, wardrobes, you know, little tchotchkes, gramophones everywhere. But solely on the walls, which I really like that concept a lot because it leaves a lot of space on the stage, which in my opinion would be, like, wonderful for rendering a one-person show, because you've got a very, like, set concept of what the show is and who the show's about, but you've got, like, the freedom of the open space to explore each dynamic personality shift as the actor moves from one character into another. I think it would be nice to end the show with a giant portrait of both the young Charlotte and, like, an old Charlotte, but, like, on the wall. So you'd end up with giant portraits of Charlotte in her own museum, and then you could, like, see how much has changed from the youth to the elderly. As far as any other lighting elements, Aaron, do you have any ideas that you might want to share with those?
For a lot of design in general, I really like the thought of just while I was reading, just being able to try and piece together a monologue. And we were talking about, you know, trying to kind of piece together a monologue regarding Charlotte's father, is it would be really cool if you were to do this with one other person only on stage, the monologue, and have that other person just be like the ominous figure in the back as you deliver the monologue, with the spotlight directly above the person giving it. Was something that I saw in my head as I was kind of trying to figure out, like, oh, how could you, you know, take these pieces and essentially, like, put them together to do something by yourself. It's a one-man show, you'd be doing it by yourself anyway, but in regards to using it for an audition or things like that, I really, really liked that idea personally, just because of, like, that's how my brain works. I really liked that idea, and I'm putting it out there so that maybe someone can put that to fruition.
No, yeah, I think that's a great idea. One of my friends actually performed a monodrama. His was like the I have seen a full length monodrama. His was like the first one I've seen. But what's really interesting is that he utilized the concept very much like what you're talking about, in that his former, or, like, other self, was just this non-speaking character in the background mm-hmm. of the show the entire time. Mm-hmm. And it was really lovely. And thinking about that, like, utilizing your idea would create such contrast. And I'm like, mm-hmm. I'm all for it. As far as sound design goes, I think there should be many sounds reminiscent of old gramophones and old phonographs, which used wax cylinders in order to create sound. Basically, it's just like an old record player. You would, I think some research would need to be done on wax cylinder sounds. I know that the New York, I don't know this for a fact, but I am fairly confident that the New York Public Library has some wax cylinder sounds available for record. So, like, digitally, but definitely, like, finding old TV interviews of Charlotte was another thing I had in mind. Because as an actor, you know, you definitely want to, especially doing biopic work, you want to really have a sense of, like, what that person was really like. And any firsthand source material is really good for emulating those character traits that made a person, you know, who they were. So, like, if Charlotte had, like, a little quirk, you could really incorporate that into your work to make it wonderful. So that's kind of a little bit more on the performance side of things, but also something to keep in mind. So for our costume design, there are two main focuses that we can point out, which is going to be one, Charlotte's general attire, which consists of a string of pearls around her neck. She always has her pearls on. Those are like a focal point for Charlotte. A black kerchief, which she keeps around her head, and a simple black dress, which she wears very consistently. And then our other outfit is going to be that of a prisoner in East Berlin during like the 1970s, under which will be Charlotte's normal attire, because after Alfred, who is the prisoner, is done with his role, the actor transforms into Charlotte. The rest of it, I think the rest wouldn't really, there wouldn't be any more costume design, I think, in my mind, if we want to keep it as like monodrama is possible. And I say this as, again, as someone who's never performed a monodrama, but like, I think really putting together the idea of characters through just physical embodiment would be a much more powerful way to indicate, like, you know, who these characters are, but also to reinforce the subversion of like gender stereotypes through that character only wearing Charlotte's attire, as the author mentioned at the start. And that is pretty much our show. Aaron, do you have any closing thoughts about this play, recommendations for it?
So I'm a big, of course, I've said I'm a big gamer. I'm just a big nerd in general. I do love cosplay, and I really, really feel like a lot of people who do cosplay can bring so much to theater, especially when it comes to like costume design and working with clothing and just the knowledge you learn about sewing and how to do all these really cool things. And so something I saw for specifically this was to have, and I've seen it done in cosplay before, I don't know exactly what it's called, but essentially it's a pair of pants that kind of looks like it has extra fabric, but only because you kind of unhook or like unlatch or Velcro, depending on what kind of resources you personally have available, you could do it differently. But it basically is supposed to turn the pants into like a skirt that you can then wear over yourself. And so it's one of those that it's like, if we're talking about the dress that we're specifically looking for, or kind of like the house dress or this article of clothing we're talking about in this setting, I really do feel like with a little extra work, a little sewing, a little motivation, you could take something as simple as an outfit change and make it even cooler. But that's just, again, it's getting that knowledge. And I mean, it's something that I really, really feel like it's not hard to do, in the sense that it's just dedicating time, and YouTube and Google are such big resources. I am a kind of person that I'm known for like Googling everything, that when watching something, people will be like, hold on, wait, Aaron has to Google this. Just because it's like, we have these resources, we have all these collectives of information in the palm of our hands every day. And it's just taking that time to use them. Yeah, I feel like those words be my closing thoughts on a lot of the end recommendations for anyone thinking about doing this in general.
Well, awesome. Then that is our show for today, y'all. So glad you could tune in with us. Check us out in 2 weeks, where we will be doing another play that is yet to be decided. who knows what it'll be. I think Aaron and I know already. Hint, bananas. A special thank you to Aaron for agreeing to do this crazy thing with me last minute. I know it was wild and I threw it on you, but you're amazing. And I think we're just going to go amazing places from here.
I agree. And I'm also going to the kitchen. I do require a snack. Drink water and take your meds to all of our listeners, because you take care of us, so we're going to take care of you.
Amen. Music by Gregor Quendel. You can find his music at gregorquendel.com. GregorQuendel.com. Thank you. Bye-bye.